welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Brad Evoy. Hello.
Hey! You're not Scotty!
I'm sorry. I mean, I would tell you where he is, but,
He's doing work with the deep state. Shh. It's a secret. No, he's not. He's out of town and actually on a business trip. It's actually...
Ooh, how fancy.
Yeah, it is pretty fancy.
Jeez, Scott.
So, yeah, he's... I think it's at a trade show in Niagara Falls. He can correct us if he's listening or when he's back next week.
Yeah,
anyway.
Exactly.
But it is a trade show. I'm not 100% sure of the location. I'm pretty sure it's the Falls, but...
Like, literally on the Falls?
Well, that'd be dope, but it's like adjacent to. I don't think it's on it anyway. We should talk about what we're going to talk about. Forget Scott; he's not here. Open Source is a CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can listen to us live online by going to CFRU.ca and clicking on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of your screen, and you can listen to us anytime by downloading the Open Sources podcast on the Podbean Guelph Politicast channel or through iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Now, today we're going to look at the latest in sexual harassment allegations in Canada and Canadian media and the Canadian politics. And boy, there hasn't even been breaking news today in that regard, too. Not just the former Minister of Sport, Ken Hur, who's now out of cabinet, not out of caucus, but a reporter for CTV. Rumors of more to come. And then it is also election time for the Russians. And you know what that means, arresting your rivals for protesting against you. And then we're going to talk about the latest from the campaign trail in Russia and what it's like to be bulldozed by Vladimir Putin. And then finally, we will mark 1 year since twin Canadian tragedies that we're not really talking much about, the mass shooting at a mosque in Quebec City and the assault of a First Nations woman in Northern Ontario. But first... the fallout continues from the Ontario Progressive Conservative announcement last week from leader Patrick Brown. He was resigning following allegations of sexual misconduct and assault made by two women to CTV News. It's been 7 days, but it's like this week has almost 70 days. And we do have breaking news before we get Brad to weigh in. But Carolyn Mulroney, the daughter of Brian Mulroney and the sister of E-Talk host Ben Mulroney, has announced her intention to run in the leadership race, which we have gotten dates. The PCs did announce when the vote will happen on March 10th. Candidates will have to be in the race by February 16th if they want to be the next leader of the Ontario PC Party, and then they will have 30 days to sign up members before that closes. Carolyn Mulroney's in the race. Christine Elliott, who came in runner-up to both Patrick Brown and Tim Hudak in those leadership races. She has been a patient ombudsman, I believe is her job title. Since retiring from Queen's Park. And, of course, we already had one candidate declare on Monday in the extravagant and cost-effective Mother's Basement.
Oh, God.
Doug Ford. I know.
I thought I would never have to talk about him again.
Well, he was running for Toronto's mayor.
I know, but after that, I mean...
We were already looking forward to never having to talk about him again. It's weird. But I know what you mean. I don't know what he's thinking. And I kind of like tried to punch out like a Twitter thread about this.
Yeah.
About like what he, like just trying to think about what his thought process is. Because when he announced he was running for mayor, and this was like 13 months before the election.
Yeah.
This was back in September. I didn't understand why he was a city councilor for one term. He was one of the most frequently absent city councilors. Mm-hmm. He really kind of had no policy except, you know, he wasn't a policy wonk. He wasn't like the opposite of Rob, where he was like wonkish and studious and steeped in policy. It seemed like he was running out of spite against, just because John Tory beat him last time. And I mean, that will almost kind of seem like why he jumped into the PC leadership race too, because there was people appealing to John Tory to step up, and so it almost feels like it's Doug Ford versus John Tory, at least in his mind. And then we get this Monday, and John Tory said, you know, came out and said a firm no, that he wasn't going to do that. He was busy being mayor of Toronto and likely running for re-election as mayor of Toronto.
Yeah, exactly. So.
And so Doug Ford, I guess, now free of the scourge of John Tory, is seeking higher. I don't know. I think there's this family mythology about, you know, dear old dad being part of the Common Sense Revolution, mm-hmm. although he was, like, Doug Ford Sr. was a backbencher
yeah.
who did not apparently do much, that he was gone in a term. It just reminded me, Rob. Say what you want about Rob Ford, he seemed to be the only one of them who was truly dedicated to any kind of public service.
I think that's fair. I mean, like, having done the, like, City Hall beat for a while for Toronto Media Co-op, like, I remember many days where, like, one or both of the Fords, if not absent, would be, like, regularly leaving city council chambers, like, in the middle of discussions to go on a smoke break repeatedly, like constantly not in the room, and would come back in for the vote and vote against, you know, progressive measures or vote for a conservative one, but then leave again, right? Both of them, both Rob and Doug, like, their style of governing generally seemed to be one of complete absenteeism until the very last minute. which, like, you know, as in terms of, like, governing, like, if he was successful in the leadership and the PCs, you know, took it, I mean, expect, like, absentee governance and a lot of political, like, public stunts. But I mean, this is what the Fords do and have always done in Toronto, it seems, at least in the past decade or so. And especially when it comes to Doug, I mean, I think that, like, you definitely have to ask a lot of questions as to why he would run, for all the reasons that you mentioned, but also for the fact that there's so many skeletons in his personal closet that have, like, come to light over the past few years. You know, there was the whole drug dealing thing a few years ago, and it's like, you'd have, like, on a very, like, logic-based track, that is the question you'd have to ask. But I think on a more emotion-based track,
mm-hmm.
I think that there's a logic to him running. And I think that's kind of terrifying, that I think there are people in the broader GTA
mm-hmm.
And in this region who mm. would vote for him. And I think that that's, like, I think there are folks where, like, the kind of talk, like, if he takes up the kind of talk that they did in municipal politics, which is a guarantee, there would definitely be folks listening. And I think that to take the position that, like, there's no logic to it, I don't think I could. Because I think that, like, seeing how, with the exception of, you know, with John Tory in Toronto recently, they've had some pretty notable successes within the family, even outside of Rob and Doug. Like, there's been members of their family that are now on council aside from them. There have been folks that are in, like, the local school board, which is usually a good predictor of folks who move up through certain political ranks.
Right.
So it's like, I don't think their charm has totally dulled for some people.
No, I mean, they still have their appeal, of course. The fact that you could substitute, you know, Michael Ford, who I think pretty much was, he was looking like he might have been the anti-Ford Ford for a while. There was this fairly glowing piece about him in the Toronto Star when he was on the school board. But then when he gets to city council and easily walks away with victory on city council, taking his uncle's seat, you know, where he's immediately, like, one of his first big things is, like, being against this King Street pilot project and how there needs to be more study about what a road hog streetcars are, and we need to get rid of them. You know, streets are for cars, blah 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 blah, you know, same old, you know, Ford talking points that, you know, sound great and maybe feel good if you're, you know, for of a certain generation or of a certain mindset, but really don't have anything behind them. I'm of two minds of it, because Doug, by and large, is carried by the Ford name and the association with Rob. And there are a lot of very fond feelings about Rob outside of crack, outside of the scandal. People remember Rob you know, as Jon Stewart said, Toronto Super, who was, you know, you call them on the phone. It's like, Rob, I've had this pothole in my street for like 8 months and I can't get public works to come up here. And Rob's like, give me 20 minutes. You know, that's 20 minutes away. I'll be there in 10. Like the Harvey Keitel character in Pulp Fiction. He'd be there with public works the next day. And he would talk to you. And he, there was this very great sense of retail politics about him. He sucked on the policy end. He sucked as someone who was trying to create, you know, collaborative government and, you know, offer genuine leadership. At some point, he got more ambition than I think he was capable of bearing. But on that very singular basic level of call Rob Ford and he will solve your little problem, he was very, very successful, and that fostered a lot of goodwill. Doug doesn't have that.
No, it's true.
And a lot of people see Doug as the angrier, thuggish, and you know, unrelatable older brother.
Yeah. And I think that's definitely, like, having been around, like, the city council chambers, that was definitely something that came through with him over and over again. That being said, like, away from the Fords for a moment, like, if...
yes, please.
Yeah. God. But, like, if, you know, if Christine Elliott is running, I think that, you know, she's had a pretty decent track record in the previous two contests. This might be the time.
Third time's a charm.
Yeah, right.
No, it's... I definitely think in... If you have a PC party who is playing smart politics and can are they're like they can taste the premiership, they can taste government again. You know, Kathleen Wynne, say what you want about her, whether you like her or you don't like her, there are a lot of people, even liberals, who are like, this government is long in the tooth. It needs to, like, go back and, you know, replant itself, be fallow for a couple of years, and then come back and, you know, maybe take some of the poison that's been in the system out. And one of the reasons why it's still there is because, by and large, the PC party hasn't been up to the job to offer an acceptable opposition or an acceptable alternative in the eyes of a lot of more moderate Ontarians.
Yeah.
A lot of centrist people, a lot of people in this area.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that's going to be the key point. In any other year, Doug Ford, I think, would have a reasonable shot. But I think in this year, a lot of PCs are going to have a very close eye. And if it's like Carolyn Mulroney, I'm not sure. Like, she was like a Wall Street banker for years. And then I guess at some point she came back to Toronto and decided she wanted to be a politician. And you know what? It's, you know, I never want to hear a just visiting thing again. I never want to hear any Tory say anything bad about Michael Ignatieff. I think if she becomes leader of the PCs, everybody who has a Tory membership card needs to, like, go to Michael Ignatieff's house and apologize in person. But, so Christine Elliott has incredible credentials. Aaron O'Toole, the Conservative MP, for the federal MP, sounds like he's making overtures. I mean, I don't know how that's going to be affected by Christine Elliott getting the race, because I think a lot of people are floating trial balloons, seeing who else might hop in. But I think someone very establishment like Christine Elliott, I think people are going to be thinking, you know what, if we'd gone with her last time, we wouldn't be in this mess now.
Yeah. And I think, like, if you look at, like, Aaron O'Toole, for example, a really interesting piece on that, like, in particular, a lot of folks who are still very aggrieved about their time in veteran affairs when they were
related
to that. Like, I know people in the veterans community will be out there immediately to oppose Aaron O'Toole. So that's so if Aaron O'Toole did enter the race, I mean, I think that would give further credence to people like, you know, Elliot.
Well, maybe, but I mean, There's something to, you know, a lot of people are looking at Aaron O'Toole as kind of like an acceptable face of conservatism. He's a personable guy. He's a small C fiscal conservative kind of deal. I mean, that was also the appeal of Lisa Raitt getting in the race as well. You know, the thing about Doug Ford is he's out there already talking about scrapping the carbon tax, although I don't think Ontario has a carbon tax. Don't we do cap and trade?
It's cap and trade.
So he doesn't even know that much about what he hates, and he's talking about revisiting the sex ed curriculum, which is something like Patrick Brown, you know, despite the fact whatever sleazeball he's alleged to be, he nipped that kind of SoCon stuff in the bud fairly early, because that's the kind of stuff that ends up sinking the PCs before they even get out of the gate. So
no, it's entirely true, but that kind of populism and aim towards the far right is definitely where, you know, Ford is going to take it. So
sure.
Like one way or the other, even if they're not the, you know, a particularly successful candidate, this is going to be out in the you know, the political sphere and in the more social sphere in a greater level than I think we've been accustomed to in the past few years, aside from like dealings with the further right.
Oh yeah, I mean that is something we're gonna have to come to terms with, you know, for the next several years, is the far right, the alt right. They're there, and you know, they're not gonna go away no matter what happens with Doug. Although Doug says if he isn't elected PC leader, he's gonna stand for election in Etobicoke North, which means he's not gonna run for mayor. You know, I'm not sure I would take Doug's word on that, but you know, we'll see. He could stay the course. We'll see. I forgot to mention this off the top, but we do have tickets to give away, as we do occasionally have tickets to give away. I know Brad's very excited for this one.
Yes.
Thursday, February the 8th at 8 p.m., GuelphToday.com is presenting the comedy series at River Run Center featuring one Louis Anderson. He is one of the world's most recognized and adored comedians. This is the station's copy, not mine, so don't send me angry tweets if you don't like Louis Anderson. He's a star of stand-up, stage, TV sitcoms, and film. Anderson's finely crafted routine, always delivered with a characteristic warmth, is sure to inspire fits of laughter. However, the language and content may offend some, so it might not be suitable for children. If this sounds interesting to you, you want to check out Louis Anderson on the River Run comedy stage, call the station now at 519-837-2378 CFRU, 519-837-CFRU. So you go to your telephonic device, whether that be a smartphone or a rotary telephone. I don't know who would have a rotary telephone anymore. You never know. But yeah, we have a pair of tickets to give away. So call the station now, and you may be a winner for Louis Anderson tickets.
That's pretty fantastic.
Yes, and what's not so fantastic is we're having a bit of a Me Too moment in Canada. We wondered when it was going to, the pendulum was going to swing up here. And it's just one of those days where there's breaking news here as well. Aaron Weir, who is a NDP member of parliament, he has been suspended. He's been accused of what's been described as harassing behavior towards women. NDP party leader Jagmeet Singh was sent a email earlier this week. And so, I mean, this is fairly swift action on his part that Aaron Weir is suspended until there has been a thorough investigation. But yeah, this comes on the heels of Steve Dykstra, Ontario PC president, allegations against him. Paul Bliss, who is covering Patrick Brown one night and is suspended from CTV News Toronto the next night after allegations himself. And of course, you know, this is bipartisan, shall we say. Cantor out of cabinet, not out of caucus yet, although there was a woman who posted to Twitter. She said when she was became a staffer at the Alberta legislature, she was warned, do not get into an elevator alone with Kentur. Which, yeah. Can you imagine being told that on your first day on the job?
That's so much.
Yeah. So it's, I mean, I think that's important to keep in mind, is this is a bipartisan issue.
Yeah.
This is about, you know, men in powerful positions. Yeah.
Yeah, no, exactly, right? And it's like these things are widespread, right? If you look at you know, all the parties, and if you widen this out to a broader margin, like in terms of the last number of years, like I can't think of exact names in terms of the Liberal Party or previous folks to this, but like this has definitely been an endemic problem in the like the national parliament, but also in the various provincial legislatures, as it is in broader society, right? Like, if we look at the stuff around, you know, Patrick Brown, the party acted more swiftly than I think a lot of folks really expected in terms of the mass resignations.
Oh, yeah.
From his office, with the, you know, complete departure of his entire upper staff.
Yeah.
Like, that is the kind of, like, pressure and, in a way, a solidarity that I think a lot of folks haven't seen in other parties and other spaces. And that's not to say that, like, the conservatives are, you know, somehow incredibly principled on these things. But at least amongst folks that were working for Patrick Brown, like, that turnover is...
Yeah. That was the amazing thing is I heard about the resignations before I heard about the
same the
allegations. I went on Twitter to find something. I was looking for, like, a specific piece of information. And I opened Twitter, and it's like, all these people from the PC party have resigned. It's like, wow, that's kind of crazy. And then, you know, you follow the Twitter thread, and in a couple of, and you see the full extent. Yeah, I mean, that was the amazing part. And I think that's the cascading effect is what's amazing, is what to see. And we've, of course, seen this in the United States, mm-hmm. where you get, like, a big fish like Harvey Weinstein. Mm-hmm. And that's, it starts this domino effect, and I think that's what we've seen with Patrick Brown as well. He was a big fish. He was the official leader of the opposition in Ontario, biggest province, most populous province. And when people see the big fish get taken out, it becomes that much easier to take out the little fish. Not that, you know, any of these guys are little in the eyes of their survivors of the victims, but still, it's amazing how fast this did happen, and it should not be surprising given what we see in the United States.
No, exactly. It is depressingly typical, mm-hmm. of mainstream politics, right, and of broader society, right? Like, I think, like, when it comes to these kinds of things coming forward, I mean, if you even look at folks, like, in terms of the broader culture of this kind of stuff, like, a few years ago, like, various activists were calling out, like, Jagmeet Singh for the way he was speaking about, you know, defending folks who were accused of sexual assault.
Right.
At a conference around this issue. This was, like, God, at least 2 years ago now, where, like, he was talking about his practice as a lawyer and, like, going beyond just, like, the idea of a public defense for folks, but talking, you know, about how he decimated a survivor's legal case.
Right.
In front of other survivors.
Yeah.
And so, like, this kind of the embeddedness of how people think about these things and how acceptable, you know, mm-hmm. to a lot of folks in power, sexual violence is really notable. I mean, we're two dudes here talking about this,
so
we can't really give the justice and the depth, I think, of how painful and horrifying these things are for a lot of the women and non-binary folks who've experienced it, you know, in these spaces.
But there's a role for that too,
you know,
being two white dudes and in terms of, like, being fostering increased awareness of, like, how you speak and what you laugh at and being sure that if you're, you know, in the company of someone talking about grabbing someone by their private parts, you're like, whoa, that's not okay.
No, exactly.
You're not sitting there cackling about it like mm-hmm. we could about another instance, a very, very famous instance on a bus we can talk about. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, too, Jagmeet Singh in his comments today said the first responsibility is to believe the survivors. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's almost, you know, what you were talking about, 180 degrees. But he's right, because, you know, thinking about this in terms of other crime, if someone comes up to you and says, like, you're just walking down the street and someone comes up to you and says, like, hey, I was robbed, is your first question to them going to be, are you sure you were robbed?
Mm-hmm.
And that, I mean, I can't remember who kind of made that point. This was back in in the fall after Weinstein, or maybe it was after Gomeshi, but somebody made that point, and that's like really stuck with me. As you know, when we're talking about sexual assault, the first question is, has always seemed to be, are you sure that what happened to you happened to you? And there's an immediate skepticism, an immediate benefit of the doubt given to the accused that you don't necessarily see in any other crime.
And I mean, like, let's be real. That all comes from the patriarchal nature of our society, right?
Absolutely.
The way that our legal system is structured. You know, there's a reason why folks who go through these processes continually run into, like, so many boundaries and barriers in terms of, like, putting forward a legal case. Because even if they're, you know, trying to forward the prosecution of their perpetrators, they're placed on the defensive from the very beginning. And so with these kind of sea changes of folks being forced to resign under these allegations, like, I think that's a really – I don't want to say it's a sea change just yet. I mean,
yeah.
I think it's hard to say that. But it's definitely heartening to see that people are actually following through with the idea of believing survivors.
Yeah. Although, I mean, I have been somewhat disheartened by some people in our media who are abnormally focused on Patrick Brown losing his job, yeah, and, you know, taking up column inches with that as if it would be okay for someone who might be the next premier of the province to be running for that office while having allegations hanging over his head about sexual assault and harassment. And of course, yeah, you never get the one instance either. There's, you know, there's a bag full of allegations waiting for somebody to take them out one at a time. And I don't know if I coined a meme there, a bag full of allegations. But the flip side of it is, too, there are a lot of Warren Kinsella, who's like a well-known political operative, wrote a blog piece about how he knows there's somebody, a big name, for whom there's affidavits against. And you have a lot of people on the conservative side of the fence, like, crossing their fingers going, let it be Trudeau. And that's, you know, that's kind of inappropriate. We're not hoping, you know, no matter where we come from on the political spectrum, we're not, like, picking favorites of who we hope is going to be cast as a villain next. And I think that's kind of a betrayal of the moment, a betrayal of a lot of principled conservatives. Vic Fedeli, who's, you know, the interim leader of the PCs, is like, well, I'm going to try, you know, root out the rot. And then hopefully he'll be as good as his word. That, you know, for people who are taking this seriously, to go on the flip side and, like, I have my fingers crossed that this politician I hate ends up being a gross sexual deviant is inappropriate.
Yeah, and I mean, like, looking at Kinsella's stuff, I mean, I always hesitate with Warren Kinsella, not because I don't believe that there are affidavits, but it's like, if there are, why are you not focused on supporting the survivors and releasing information at their time rather than trying to, you know, tempt people with this idea of a mystery? It's like, that's so inappropriate.
Yeah,
it just rings so hollow. It's like, this isn't another, like, political point to score. This is people's lives. This is what people have suffered through and have grown, like, in terms of being able to rebuild their lives. So it's like, come on, Kinsella.
I think what Warren might need is some rebel knowledge.
I think that's true all of the time.
I'm trying to tee you up to talk about rebel knowledge.
Yes. So rebel knowledge is Oprah Guelph's Social and Environmental Justice Symposium, where we bring together, like, social and environmental justice activists, researchers, and a whole bunch of different folks. I also work at Oprah Guelph in my day job. And so we're really excited to be able to put this together. And so we've got a whole bunch of panels, some panels that will be touching on some of the topics that we've talked about, you know, thus far, around sexual violence. In interest to Warren, there will be a panel on anti-fascism.
If he's listening.
If you're listening, Warren Kinsella.
there'll be a panel on anti-fascism. That's something that Kinsella's been really involved in around stuff around Your Ward News, the Wayward neo-Nazi newspaper in Toronto. So we're going to be having a whole bunch of different areas of focus, as well as some really excellent keynote presentations and a keynote panel. And we're also doing a book launch on the 9th with the book Unsettling the Commons. That's going to be at The Common, which will be...
How ironic.
Which will be definitely unsettled. around... so we're going to be having the author in with that, as well as myself and Amber Holmes on a panel to talk about it. So it'll be really great.
Excellent. And that's your good news for the day, because when we get back, we're going to have some more not-so-good news. You are listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
You shouldn't forget to see what you mean to me.
And that was a bit of Oscar and Ella, Ella Fitzgerald and Oscar Peterson. And that's just a little taste of Black History Month. That is from their combined album effort from 1976, Ella and Oscar. And I thought that would be apropos for Black History Month and February. And to choose a song called Mean to Me, I think there's some people in Russia who are wondering, why is Vladimir Putin being so mean to me? Like Alexei Navalov, Navalny, I should say. Alexei Navalny, who was having a moment last Sunday, or rallying people. Of course, he's kind of seen as the primary opposition leader in Russia, although he is not allowed to run, presumably because of his criminal record. He was charged with embezzling, I want to say.
Yeah, it was a corruption-related charge. Yeah. I forget the exact terminology used, but it was definitely corruption.
Yeah, and what I found out was interesting was, like, he's gone to, like, the European, like, Human Rights Tribunal to try and make a case that he and his business partner were kind of, like, essentially framed by Putin, like, to send him to jail for a year so he'd be ineligible. Mm-hmm. The European Union... this court said that, well, you know, maybe you weren't framed so much, but on the other hand, you shouldn't be allowed to run. Of course, Vladimir Putin is unlikely to do as the European Union is going to tell him to do. So,
I would say almost certainly. relations between the European Union and Russia being particularly low.
Yeah. Yeah, so he has this this protest last Sunday where he gets arrested again, although I think that's kind of pro forma. If he shows his face in public, he's arrested. It's sad. It's really sad that, you know, there is a lot of tremendous enthusiasm. I mean, one of the reasons they're afraid of him is that there's all this enthusiasm around him, particularly youth enthusiasm.
Yeah, and I think, like, with his arrest in this case, the charge was around, like, kind of a public disruption charge around, like...
Yeah, he didn't have the proper permit
you know. Which, I mean, like this is the classic, like, disruptor protest kind of maneuver. Yeah. It's like, you know, the state does this in Russia, but they also do it here.
This is
a typical way for like, state forces to silence dissent. And it's disgusting.
But, yeah.
I hate to make it sound like it's very garden variety. It's your garden variety repression.
Variety repression.
You know, but in this case too, it's yeah. I've been trying to catch up as much as I can on this story for today, and I find it really interesting. Because one of the articles from the CBC on this, at least, they make a point to, like, speak about, like, the youth engagement around his protests and the level of, you know, outrage in areas, particularly outside of Moscow, around his various repression experiences with like state repression. But what's interesting too is they also make a note that the number of people at his rallies have been declining, which is I'm not really sure what that indicates, if that's to do with, you know, a drop in support, or if it's more so due to fears of state repression that people are staying home.
It also might be due to, it's like, it's January in Russia.
Yeah,
I mean, exactly. There was the Women's March on the first anniversary of Trump's inauguration that had, you know, a couple of million fewer people out, because, mm-hmm. I mean, it's the second year, and it's, you know, theoretically, I think people are looking at, like, oh, it's been a year since he's in office. Why aren't people more angry? And I think for a lot of people who are on sort of Team Navalny, I don't know why I cut off the Y, but Navalny, you know, he's been out there, you know, trying to take it to Putin since, like, 2012. Mm. So there's just like maybe a general frustration like with people, like we're tapped out, we're tired of like protesting all the time, and maybe we'll save our powder for like actually trying to go out and vote. But I mean, even that's tricky because, you know, you look at what's going on with Russian interference in elections abroad as well. This mechanism that Putin has created, and which almost seems like built on kind of almost his entire reputation that he probably enjoys, that he's a supervillain. But, you know, there's also been a lot of reporting about the harm he's doing to the state by making Russia basically all about him. And there was a piece in The Atlantic about what he's doing, Putin, I mean. He's actually going about now sort of keenly aware of what might happen when he eventually decides to give up power, and he's kind of testing out loyal people, like people he's helped make rich, former bodyguards, you know, by giving them sort of local governorships and other little pieces in the government to see how they do, because it seems to be top of mind to him now what's going to happen when he's not in power anymore. Like, is he going to need protection when he's not in power? And I think that's the interesting part of this. It's kind of the desperate, you know, clawing onto power.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think when you look at, like, for the parties that are still in, like, electoral positions, it's really interesting to see what opposition, like, remains outside of Navalny.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there doesn't seem to be a huge vocal, even in, like, you know, Russian sources or, like, alternative media sources, a lot of folks who are, like, speaking strongly in opposition to like the more nationalist kind of rhetoric that comes up in Putin stuff. And I think that really it's a question of like, you know, would any successor continue forward with that kind of approach? Because that seems to be the winning formula in a whole bunch of places, but in Russia as well.
Right.
You know, there's still, you know, some of the older parties that pre-exist Putin's, you know, grasp on power.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even the old, like, or revitalized Communist Party that still sits in opposition, in some form.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, so like, in terms of this kind of stuff, I always wonder, you know, any successor that Putin puts in place, I mean, likely would not be able to maintain his party's grasp. And then the question becomes, which actual successor within the state would aim to reproduce that kind of nationalist rhetoric that seems to be the, you know, the winning formula.
Right, because, you know, the people in opposition are, like, the primary people in opposition are almost, like, the opposite of nationalistic, because they're, mm-hmm. like, the prime opponent for a president is this woman, Kensia Sobchak, who's mm-hmm. the daughter of Putin's mentor, who's well-known in Russia for being basically a reality TV star from like their version of Big Brother or something.
Oh, yeah.
And she kind of parlayed that into some kind of media career. But, you know, a lot of people are looking at her because she's well known, she's famous, she's young, she's like 36 or 37. But, you know, I was reading an independent piece where she took this trip to like Chechnya, where, you know, not really the garden spot of the Russian Empire. But, you know, there seemed to be this, like, sort of organized effort to dismiss her. Mm-hmm. You know, there's this meme about her having a horse face, and so, like, a lot of people are calling like, horsey and things, which is, has a so it's kind of misogynist smell to it. Like, you know, you're a woman, you're not good looking. But yeah, it just, you know, she had like several days planned out, but ended up leaving like after a couple of hours because there was just seemed to be no reception there for her at all. And it's pretty ballsy of her to go to these places in the first place. Mm. But, if this is the primary opposition, or at least in terms of someone who might, who is legally able to sit in the president's office, you know, it's still, you know, the March election is more or less a foregone conclusion, which getting back to getting people out and active, you know, when you're looking at this and you're seeing these things and seeing the Putin machine in full effect, you know, obviously, you know, why waste your time?
Yeah, I think a level of disaffection would be pretty understandable amongst folks, right? Like, if there's one thing that Putin is very good at, it's whipping up a very clear, like, nationalist kind of rhetoric that appeals to some and will demobilize others, right? And while there are definitely other parties and other folks that are out there that can run and engage, the effectiveness against that kind of well-worn, highly nationalistic machine is dubious at best.
Yeah, for sure. Speaking of well-worn machines, this past Monday, it was the one-year anniversary of a pair of tragedies. I mean, the one is fairly well-known, which is the mass shooting at a Quebec mosque. But there was another one that I admittedly I did not know as much about, which was about Barbara Kentner in Thunder Bay, who was walking home with her sister one night along the road. A car full of people throw a trailer hitch at her. It hits her in her stomach, and four very painful, what were surely painful months later, she passes away in hospital. They are currently, I guess, getting ready to put this man on trial, Braden Bushby. One of the things that sticks out to me, or stuck out to me in reading about this, is I don't know about you. You suggested this topic, but in terms of my reading of some of the articles, I haven't read why he did it.
And honestly, like, there hasn't been much disclosed in terms of motivation beyond plain old white supremacy.
Well, that's the thing is, I was reading an older article from around the time this happened. Apparently, this is a thing in Thunder Bay. You drive around and you throw stuff at people walking along the road from your car more often than not. Because of economic conditions, this person is identifies as First Nations, as Indigenous. So it's, you know, it's just bizarre. The report was that, you know, the truck hitch was thrown from the car. It hits Ms. Kentner, and apparently from the someone goes like, "Oh, you got her," or something to that effect. And it's bizarre, like, this game. And in so much as I think we're sort of those of us who are interested in seeing justice for our First Nations friends. You know, the charge was initially aggravated assault. I think it was up to second-degree murder. Yeah. But, again, the thing that just is in the back of my mind that is sticking with me is that we have no idea why this guy did it. Like, was it a game? And, like, what kind of awful, terrible game is this that you throw stuff at your car, from your car at people, no matter what their race? But, I mean, because it is Northern Ontario and there are so many First Nations people up there, we can't ignore the racial angle of it either.
Yeah, and I mean, I think, like, when you look at, like, the fallout around things around this issue and people advocating loudly for Barbara Kentner and her family, the reaction in Thunder Bay at the time was one of, you know, piling on with further, like, anti-Indigenous sentiment and straight-up racism, right? Like, it's, and I think, like, if you look at, like, what happened in Thunder Bay, if you look at, like, in the case of the mosque shooting, like in the year since, like, hate crimes in Quebec City have increased.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can't remember the exact statistic offhand, but like, there's been a notable increase in the past number of years in mm-hmm. Quebec City, and Quebec City is like one of the key like battlegrounds with Le Meute, which is essentially a neo-Nazi organization
mm-hmm.
In Quebec. So it's like the thing I think that links both of these cases quite particularly
mm-hmm.
is like a structural acceptance of white supremacist violence.
Right.
And it's like the commentary in Thunder Bay around like Barbara Kentner, like in repeated like issues around social media where folks would comment on articles or folks would be, you know, responding to posts from the family or posts from, you know, supporters that were made public with like the most vile, like anti-Indigenous kind of statements
and baseless rumors and innuendo as well.
Exactly. Right. So it's like this is and this is the typical kind of thing that you see when it comes to, you know, cases that involve Indigenous folks, like there's a case in Saskatchewan around like the murder of Colton Bushy, and it's like
that's right
similar sorts of things.
Right. For people who don't know, Colton Bushy was driving home from a day out with friends. I don't know if he was the driver or he was mom, but they get a flat tire. They go to the nearest residence and he is shot. And the accusation is that he and his friends were going to rob the place. Typical kind of white panic kind of thing. And of course there was news in that this week because a number of the Indigenous people in the area are concerned about the fair trial for Stanley, who was the farmer, because it is an all-white jury.
Yeah, and they screened out every Indigenous person who
that's right
who made themselves known in that way, right? Like, you know, it's something that's like it's something that if as much as we talk about reconciliation and as much as we talk about like combating bigotry
mm-hmm.
in like so-called Canadian society, it's like these cases I think should really highlight for us how unexceptional violence and unexceptional it is to see these kinds of things. Like, we need to keep the memory alive of the of folks who have been victims and survivors of these kind of incidences, but this is a part of the Canadian fabric, and I think that's something that a lot of people, probably folks listening, might wince at a little bit, but it definitely is there, and it occurs too often for it to be something that is just out of the blue.
Yeah, and you know, it's to go back to the Quebec City Mosque too. This facility has been a target. This wasn't some random thing that Alexandre Bissonnette just sort of picked out of a hat. You know, this mosque had like a pig's head put in front of it the summer before. This was the mosque that very famously could not buy space for a Muslim cemetery until the Quebec City mayor kind of stepped in. And then after that, 36 hours after that, the president of the Islamic Center, whose name is Mohammed Labidi, his car was torched.
Yeah.
36 hours after the mayor, I think perhaps and probably in retrospect, quite bravely came out to stand up for these his citizens' rights.
Yeah.
You know, the president, you know, his car is torched, which is just incredible. So you can't look at this and not say that we are, I guess, maybe immune to some of the sentiment that we see south of the border.
Yeah.
It's quite real, and this week's episode of Canada Land I thought was quite poignant in terms of pointing out I can't remember the guest's name, but he was talking about how it's kind of acceptable violence against Muslims is acceptable, how we kind of just sort of, you know, whether that's here, you know, with these six people who were killed in the mosque shooting this time last year, or whether it's overseas with, you know, people dying by the millions in places like Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria. It's just, you know, that's life.
No, exactly, right? I mean, it says a lot about the value that, like so-called Canadian or Western societies put on Muslim lives, right? Like, if we can continually just say, oh, well, that's just too bad, or not even that, and just be like, you know, wave our flags and be cool with these things happening. Like, the reality is that, like, the decisions that our broader society makes and has made allows this kind of stuff to happen.
Right.
This isn't like, as I had said earlier, exceptional.
Right. On the other hand, Cornwallis is erected no more in Halifax.
It's so lovely. I've been seeing a lot of folks from, you know, my fellow Mi'kmaq pals, and it's just, it's lovely. I'm so happy to see Cornwallis.
Because you're an East Coaster. People maybe not know you're an East Coaster, so this is your not your exact neck of the woods, but closer to your neck of the woods than where you are presently seated.
Yeah. I'm originally from Newfoundland, but it's like it's all Mi'kmaq-y. So it's like
it's all Mi'kmaq-y.
You know. But we're I've got to say it's so great. Like I know some of the folks that have been, like, I've met some of the folks who've been involved in some of this stuff, and you know, it's great to see him gone. I hope they toss him into the sea. Like, you know, it's good to take down, like, because I also have a background in history, and there's lots of folks who talk about, like, you know, monuments is with the need of, like, you know, no matter what they did, we need to preserve them, we need to keep them close. But it's like, you can take them down out of public places. You can still talk about things that, you know, folks like Cornwallis have done, which includes, like, the like, mass... like violence and scalping of you know, my people. So it's like folks are gonna have the feeling of like wanting to take these kind of things and put them in their proper context, which is around the violence that you know, Cornwallis has orchestrated and established as the norm, you know, in our territories.
Excellent point. And that's just the kind of point you can expect at when you get some rebel knowledge next weekend.
We've definitely got a few panels on Indigenous sovereignty and solidarity. So expect that as well.
Well, Brad, I appreciate so much for you filling in for Scotty.
Yeah, I'm happy to fill his chair, his big chair. These are big shoes to fill.
They are big shoes.
As he enjoys the falls.
They're worker shoes.
Yes, they are.
Well, thanks again so much for taking part. I'll let you plug your other show in a sec. I just want to say for our fans and listeners, we are preempted this time next week for Black History Month programming. However, Scotty and I will be producing a special podcast edition of Open Sources Guelph, which you'll be able to download from the podcast channel at 5 p.m. next Thursday. So you'll be able to listen to it on Stitcher, Google Play, or iTunes, or whatever you listen to your podcasts on. You will not be able to hear us on CFRU, but we'll be back the following Thursday on the 15th, and we will carry on from there. You can stay connected to us at opensourcesguelph.com, Open Sources Newswire on the Facebook, at @OS_Guelph on the Twitters. And you can, as I said, find us on the Guelph Politicast channel through Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. I will be found at Twitter at Adam A. Donaldson, and go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca. Brad, where can people find you on the internet?
Yeah, so folks can find me at, I guess for my radio show, Terminal Degree, Mondays Mondays at noon. You can find me there. You can also find that show at Terminal Degree Show on Facebook. You can also check us out on Mixcloud as well at Terminal-Degree. You can also find me on Twitter, Brad_Evoy. I'm not so active there anymore, but if you like, throw a rock at me on Twitter, I will respond with lots of tweets.
Digital rock, not real rock.
I mean, whatever works.
Whatever works. All right, let's get out of here before DJ Sounds Good to Me throws a rock. She will be here at the top of the hour on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio, and we will see you at least on the podcast next Thursday at 5 p.m.